exploration, spirituality, universal truth, occultism, symbolism, shamanism, entheogens, conspiracy theory, UFOlogy, metaphysics, astrophysics,
Welcome everyone, indeed, to the Cosmic Gnostic Radio Podcast. My name is John Cale, and I'm hailing once again from Charleston, South Carolina, in the United States of America. And this is episode 61 of the podcast series on this March 24th of 2011. And for this show, we have special guest John Lash, author of Not in His Image, Gnostic Vision, Sacred Ecology, and the Future of Belief, with us discussing philosophy of his radical revision of Gnosticism and its true message. We compare other myths and establish the importance of the Sophia myth. We go through the origins of humanity and where we're headed if we don't recognize the influence of the alien archonic energy that has been flowing in our Milky Way galaxy, that's been undermining the Gaian Sophia human earthling experiment. This is a very important show, and I highly recommend looking into John's website over at www.metahistory.org. He's got a handful of books out there that you can also check out, and I'm just going to jump right into this one because it goes for about an hour and a half. And again, everyone, thanks for your support. In the past few weeks, we've had some generous donations that have helped keep this going, so I wanted to thank everybody that's been doing what they can out there in these hard times, and I hope you just enjoy this show, so enjoy it. Thanks. So I'd really like to start this at the beginning. At the beginning for folks that aren't aware of this story, because I think it's a very imperative portion of your work. But if you could, please explain to us what the Gaian human experiment is, and I guess get into what the other side of this is, which is the archonic energy that is out there trying to prevent her from her experiment.
Sure, sure. I would love to do that. As you know, in my book, Not in His Image, I present this myth, which is called the myth of the fallen Sophia. The goddess Sophia, the myth of the fallen goddess. It's called by various names, but the central figure of this myth is a goddess being, a divine goddess being called Sophia or Sophia, and that name means wisdom. And the unique thing about this myth that I would bring to the attention of everyone who's encountering it for the first time is that there is no other myth like this in the entire world. That sounds like an extravagant statement, but to my knowledge, that statement is absolutely correct. You know, if when I put a label on myself, John, sometimes I call myself a comparative mythologist, you know. I've used that term, and I have been compared to other comparative mythologists, you know, such as Joseph Campbell and Merce Eliade, who were the two well-known comparative mythologists who both died at the end of the 20th century. And just like to point out by way of introduction to myself what it means to be a comparative mythologist. It simply means that they're very rare, very, very rare. I would say right now, I would estimate that in the world today, in the universities and schools, there are maybe at most 10 comparative mythologists, maybe less. The reason for that is because most people who study mythology in the university concentrate on one particular vein or one particular genre or culture. For instance, you might specialize in Greek mythology or Celtic or Polynesian, or you might specialize in the mythology of the American Indians, right? It's a specialist training when you go to the university. This rare beast called the comparative mythologist is actually someone who takes a few steps back and looks at all of the myths of the world, all the myths of every single culture you can think of. And that's what I have done. And so I feel a certain qualification to say to people who are coming to this subject for the first time, to make a remarkable announcement to them. I've studied creation myths. That's the term for the myths that tribes and cultures have used to describe the origin of the world and the origin of humanity. They're called creation myths, okay? Mm-hmm. I've studied creation myths from every culture you can imagine. You name it. Polynesian, Siberian, Greek, Japanese, Aztec, everything. And I can tell you that as a comparative mythologist, there is one myth, creation myth, that is absolutely unique. There is nothing else like it. And that is this myth of the goddess Sophia.
And this is an old myth.
It's an old myth. It's a very, very ancient myth. We don't know how old it is. And I want to point out also, as an introductory comment, before I go into what this myth actually says, I would like to say something about the idea of a myth itself, okay, if I might say that. We tend to use the word myth as to mean a falsity, something that's false. Oh, that's just a myth, you know. Like we can say, what? Oh, the myth of male superiority, you know. That's just a myth, you know. Or we can say the myth of 9/11, you know. Unfortunately, this is very unfortunate. Since the period of the Enlightenment, which is about 1700, because of a reductionist and materialist mentality that has dominated the Western world, we tend to now think that a myth is something made up. It's make-believe. It's false. But this is not the case. In the actual meaning of myth, the original meaning, myth just means a story. If, for instance, in the Greek world, if you were living in the Greek world 2,000 years ago, and I said to you, hey, John, you know, I took a trip up to the mountains yesterday. I want to tell you what happened up there. Tell you a story about what happened to me in the mountains. I would use the word myth, mythos. I would say I've got a mythos about what happened to me in the mountains. You see?
Yeah.
So we have to remind ourselves of the original meaning of this word. It is not a fabrication. It is not a fiction. But it is a true story or a true description of something that actually happened in human evolution or that happened in cosmic evolution. So that's why myths are so important, because they contain true stories. Sometimes you have to decode those stories. Sometimes, obviously, a myth is told in a kind of poetic or allegorical fashion, obviously. But sometimes, decode those stories, you find truth about things that really happened. So there is this unique myth that I discovered in the Gnostic writings. These Gnostic writings primarily have a textual basis. They have various sources, but the primary textual basis is 13 books or bound papyrus leaves that were found in Egypt in 1945. And these are called the Nag Hammadi codices, codices meaning book. This is a very important archaeological discovery. And in these codices, these Nag Hammadi writings, I found the remnants, the remains, the traces of a fantastic, profound myth. that is unlike any other that I have ever seen. And this is the myth of the fallen goddess Sophia. So, why is this myth so important? Well, John, it answers your question. It tells us what is the human experiment. It actually tells us how the human species originated, and it tells us how we got to be on Earth, how the Earth was created, and explains the origin and conditions of the human existence on Earth. And of course, you could say, now just hold on a minute, you could say that there are other myths that claim to do the same thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's the first one that comes to mind?
Well, the ancient Sumerian creation myth.
The Anunnaki myth. Anunnaki mm-hmm. creation myth.
Yeah.
Also the Bible, which is in certain respects related to the Anunnaki myth.
Yeah.
And then adapted from it. You know, we know that the Anunnaki Sumerian myth was preceded the Bible, and that many elements in Genesis of the Bible were taken or borrowed from the Sumerian mythology. Okay, so Sumerians had an idea, had a story, a mythos about the origin of humanity and so forth. But I'll have you note, the Anunnaki myth does not explain the origin of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Does not explain how the Earth was created. Doesn't contain that explanation, not specifically. And so there are other myths. There's the myth of the Bible. So it's natural for anyone who encounters this myth for the first time to ask how I can make this claim that it is so unique. Well, that's where I would require people to listen to the myth, to listen to what I say about it, and to decide for themselves. The proof in its uniqueness is when you engage in it, when you actually listen to it and get involved, when you open your mind to it, then you can begin to see that it really explains things and says things that cannot be found anywhere else. And it explains the nature of what I call the divine experiment, which is what is happening to humanity on Earth. Is that clear so far?
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So what is this divine experiment, and how does the Gnostic myth of Sophia lay it out for us? I'll give it to you in 4 minutes, if I can, in the most succinct way possible. By the way, I want to preface it by saying, I'm not making any of this up. This is not my fantasy. I haven't channeled this. This is actually drawn from the textual materials and can be supported by these ancient Gnostic writings. Okay, is that understood?
Yep.
First thing they tell us is that life on Earth, the planet Earth, and the presence of the human species on Earth goes back to the galactic center. They don't trace it back to some strange, unknown origin place in the universe. They don't talk about the universe in some vague way. They talk about this galaxy. We now know from the Hubble telescope and from the astronomical science of the last 30 or 40 years, we now know we have a very clear picture of our cosmic environment, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
We know that we live in a galaxy. Well, what is a galaxy? A galaxy is a vast whirlpool, a vast pinwheel whirlpool of stars. The stars are floating, or actually flowing, navigating in the limbs of the galaxy. And our galaxy has either 4 or 5 limbs. It depends on how you analyze it. We have, which are called the spiral arms. And these spiral arms come out from a core. Now, what is at the core of our galaxy? Well, the spiral arms are defined by the vast population of stars that are floating in them. And many of these stars have planetary systems around them. So there's vast possibilities in the galactic arms for civilizations to arise and for creatures and sentient beings like ourselves to appear. But all of this activity in the galactic arms rotates around the galactic core. And in the galactic core, there are no stars. The galactic core is a realm of pure stellar plasma. It's like a wellspring of the energy and luminosity that stars are born from. So we can have, and in fact, I think every 12-year-old child who goes to science class in school today ought to have this picture of what it is to live in a galaxy. The galaxy is a vast rotating wheel of stars with a plasma well of light energy at the center. And we are located in the third arm of a four-armed lenticular spiral galaxy. Uh-huh. Lenticular meaning it's shaped like a lentil. If you look at it sideways, it has a bulge in the middle and it has very, very thin, almost paper-thin limbs. That's science. Well, that very same science that we have today was known and clearly seen by the Gnostics of thousands of years ago. Whether they had instruments and telescopes or not, perhaps they did. But one thing that I'm certain of is that they had the perception. They had the faculties of perception that would allow them to look into the universe and actually see it and see its structure. So they describe a galaxy, our galaxy. The Gnostic myth is about something that happened in our galaxy, not about something that happens in the universe at large or some vague cosmic place, but specifically our home galaxy, which has, I think, what do they say, 200 billion stars? Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, 200 billion stars. One of them is the sun, around which is circulating the Earth and other planets. We now know, of course, that there are many other stars in our galaxy that could support planetary systems. So there are obviously many other civilizations in our galaxy. The Gnostic myth of the divine Sophia says that humanity, the human species, did not originate on another world. We didn't come here from another planet. We didn't come here from another star system in the galaxy. We came here from the core of the galaxy. Now, how could that possibly be? Well, the Gnostic creation myth, if you want to call it that, gives a vivid picture of how this happened. According to this, and this is how the divine experiment was set up, as it were. Myth says that in the center of our galaxy are living these gods. And the Gnostic word, or the Greek word for gods in this writings is aeons, A-E-O-N-S, the aeons. And these gods should not be envisioned as people. I really want to emphasize this. They should not be envisioned as Anunnaki, as godlike entities having any kind of physical bodies. They should not be envisioned in an anthropomorphic way. The best way to envision these divine entities that live in the galactic core is as serpents, or great torrents of power, great torrents of energy, snake-like torrents of energy that dance and surge in the galactic core. Do not project on them a human face or a figure of they are angelic or anything like that. That is completely wrong. They are way, way beyond any human type manifestation. Okay? Is that clear?
Yes.
And so these aeons at the galactic core, according to the Gnostic myth, are actually kind of like divine engineers. They're scientists, but they're also, they love to play. They love to play and experiment. They're alive. They're alive in some fantastic supernatural way. They are pure energy bodies. And one of the things they do is that they conceive experiments. among themselves, they engineer in their minds an experiment just the way that we might get a group of people together, a team of people, and cook up some kind of experiment that we're going to exercise.
They're creative.
They're very creative. They're very playful. And they love, above all things, and this is so important, they love what is called in the Greek the monogenes. The monogenes really means singularity, because mono means singular or one, and genes means generating. So monogenes means they love experiments in which there is a singularity. They don't like to repeat things over and over again. They're more like artists and scientists who like to just go from one fantastic experiment to the other. So one thing that you need to understand to try to reach in your imagination to these divine beings is that they are playful. They love novelty. They love change. They love everything that is open-ended and creative. And so the story says that there were two particular divine beings or aeons in our galactic center who are called Sophia and another one. The name of the second one is variously given, but sometimes, most often, it is said that the second aeon was called Christos. I must warn, however, that the Gnostic use of the word Christos cannot be confused with the biblical Christos of Christianity. They are not the same entity. So, the story says that Sophia and Christos, she is the female god, he is the male god. There is gender among divine beings, by the way. It's more like positive and negative charge in electricity. Mm-hmm. But the positive and negative electrically charged gods created between themselves through their conjugal union, through their tantra, as it were, they created and imagined a species, a new species. And they called the species the Anthropos. Anthropos, which is the basis of the word anthropology. It means the human species. So if you ask the question, where was the human species come from? The Gnostics would say, we were engineered as a creative project in the galactic center. This is absolutely clear. So what happens next? Well, there's a really big question here. How, if these gods create and engineer and conceive an experiment in the galactic center, how do they actually set that experiment in motion? This is the question that anyone would ask. And again, the Gnostic mythology, according to the materials I've investigated, gives a very clear answer to this. It says essentially that once they have engineered, that is, that they have imaginatively produced a plan or template for a species, which is the human species, they project or emanate that template into the galactic arms. They actually deposit it out in the realm of the galactic arms. And then they let it germinate. Very similar to the way that a sperm deposits itself in the wall of a uterus and combines with an ovum to produce a body. You can say like that the template of the genome of the human species, the anthropos, is like that fertilized ovum. And they project it by their intention, which is called enoia. Their intention, the very power of their intention, projects it out into the cosmic arms of the spiral galaxy, and it is seeded in the spiral galaxy. And then from the place where it is seeded, and in our case, that was in the third arm of the galaxy, close to the constellation of Orion, then it proceeds to germinate from that seed. And that is how the experiment develops. And then the gods, who are kind of in the control booth at the center of the galaxy, sort of look out and watch how these fantastic experiments unfold. And the thing that they love the most about these experiments, which they enjoy, is that they don't usually interfere with the experiment that they've set in motion. They love to see how it will unfold on its own terms. And so the general rule in the creation of such experiments is that the aeons at the galactic core hold back and they simply observe what happens, but they are like scientists who set an experiment in motion, but they don't meddle with the experiment. They sit back and watch how it develops. Is that clear so far?
Yes, and this all is very scientifically based at the same time. They call this panspermia.
Panspermia, that's right. They call it panspermia. Panspermia is a really important word. As far as I know, John, the Gnostic text from Nag Hammadi would be the earliest textual evidence that the ancients knew about panspermia. Because there are about five or six cosmological documents in the Nag Hammadi writings. A lot of them are very jumbled. A lot of them are confusing. Some of them are not even Gnostic. They're kind of a mess. But there are about five or six cosmological documents that describe the scenario that I'm paraphrasing for you. And one of them called Eugnostos, E-U-G-N-O-S-T-O-S, the Eugnostos, is very clear in saying that the anthropos is a template from which many strains of the human species could develop. It's a panspermic strain. So one of the things that the Gnostics appeared to know, which we're only verifying recently, is that the human species, us, can exist in numbers of strains on planetary systems all through our galaxy. We are just one strain, but there are human civilizations elsewhere in the galaxy, according to this panspermic vision of the Gnostics. So it's very contemporary, fits beautifully with the most state-of-the-art astronomy that we have.
Yes, and they are also, scientists are just openly admitting that they know that there are other worlds out there, much like Earth, and there are just more than they can even number. So
that's
the possibility
right.
of human-like life out there is quite possible.
Quite possible. Much more likely than unlikely.
Yeah.
You know, they started looking not too long ago, I think only 10 or 15 years ago, I remember, the race, the big thing in science, was the race to find Earth-like planets. Remember that idea? Oh, we're going to look at stars. We're going to scrutinize stars now that we have this high-tech technology of orbiting telescopes. And we're going to figure out which of these stars could, like our star, support Earth-like systems. And then they found one, and their minds were blown. But then the next week, they found eight. And then the week after that, they found 20, you know. And
who
so their minds were... Their minds were blown so many times, you know. Okay.
Well, what's interesting about all that is that the story that you're explaining here has already been written down so long ago. And
that's right.
To this day, now these scientists are confirming all these things.
That's
but
right.
Please go on.
Okay, now I'll come to the crunch of the story. They preserved in their mythology a story about this particular aeon or divine being called the Sophia. Now remember that from the Gnostic point of view, Sophia and Christos are two entities in the galactic center. And they are, in a sense, the parents of humanity. They are not our parents in the sense of our biological parents, but they are the designers of the human genome. The two of them together, it's as if there was a team of scientists who are all the gods in the galactic center. But out of that team, a couple, a pair, were given the mission to design a genomic template, and they designed the human genome. So after the human genome, called the Anthropos, was designed, as I say, it was projected out into the galactic limbs, and from there it could grow in and emerge on different planetary systems. However, at this point, something unusual took place. And again, this is where I have to tell you, I cannot emphasize how fantastic this is, because it describes things that you just do not find anywhere else. And at first it seems complicated and bizarre, perhaps. But the more you look into it, the more sense it makes. Gnostic said that at the moment that the Anthropos had been seated in the galactic limbs, all of the aeons in the Pleroma withdrew. It withdrew to the center of the galaxy, which is kind of like the still point of the turning wheel. And from that still point, they could then have a perfect omniscient observance. They could sit back, as it were, in the control booth, and they could watch this experiment unfold. They could watch what happened as the human template appeared and seeded itself and evolved in different worlds. But Sophia, who was involved in engineering that template, didn't react that way. And the myth is very clear about this. It says that the Aeon Sophia, the goddess Sophia, was fascinated by the possibilities of this Anthropos creature. And rather than taking the usual position of the gods, which was to draw back in detachment and just watch what happened, she went toward the boundary of the galactic core. You can sort of imagine her in an observation booth, if you want to use that example. All the other scientists in the observation booth are sitting at their seats in the theater of the observation booth. They're sitting at their seats watching the experiment that they have invented start to unfold. But Sophia goes right down to the window and presses her nose against the glass of the observation booth, you know? And that is described, that's my metaphor, of course, but in the text it's described by saying that Sophia extended herself to the storos, or horos, meaning the limit of the galactic core. She went right to the limit because she was so interested in watching what would happen. And in fact, she had her own idea. She had her own idea. She thought, wow, this Anthropos creature is really fantastic. And I can sort of see it in a world of three bodies. I can see it in a world where there's a sun, central star, and then around that star, there are kind of like two planets, kind of twin planets, kind of circulating around each other. At the same time, they're circulating around that star. And I could see that the Anthropos would arrive through space. You know how we arrive on planets?
How
does this, by what is called propagules, by shielded particles of organic matter. Particles of organic matter. For instance, I don't know if you've ever heard about a certain meteor that fell in France in about the 1860s. Can't give you the name of the town where it fell. I forget it right now. But when this meteor fell and arrived in France, it was pretty big. And some scientists picked it up and put it in a museum and left it there. And then over the years, various scientists went and looked at it, studied it. It's a big chunk of rock that fell out of space. And at one point, I wish I could give you more details on this. I haven't researched it lately. I forgot a lot of things. But a number of scientists, when they had sufficient knowledge to understand organic life in the universe, realized that there were traces of organic molecules in this meteorite. So you just spoke of panspermia, which means the seeding of life in many worlds, right?
Yes.
So if we're going to accept the possibility of transpermia, we have to understand, or we have to consider, what might be the mechanism of it. And it's known, as far as I can tell, that the mechanism is that spores that are sealed, they're like freeze-dried spores of living molecules actually float through space. They can float freely in space like dust, or they can also be carried by meteors and comets. And when these free-floating spores, which are called propagules, P-R-O-P-A-G-U-E-L-E-S, when these propagules enter an atmosphere and descend, if the conditions of that atmosphere are adequate, if that atmosphere will accept and nurture organic life, they sprout. And they grow into living forms. So, Gaia, let's go back to, no, not Gaia, but Sophia, as she's called, let's go back to the scenario. As she was looking from the galactic core, she thought, boy, I can see this human anthropos template. I can see some spores on this template drifting through space. And wow, it would really be fantastic if they, like, landed in this world where there is only three bodies, in this system where there is only three bodies, a sun and a couple of planets kind of revolving around each other, twin planets revolving around the sun, and then the human species emerged on these planets, and she had this whole fantasy going by herself. Now, this is very, very odd, because normally the eons wouldn't do this. It wasn't like part of, you know, their scientific method, you know?
Yeah.
She had observed the scientific method in designing the template, but then she got obsessed and fascinated by the experiment. So the story goes, to cut to the chase, that Sophia became so enthralled and so fascinated by the possibilities of what could happen with this anthropos template, the human genome, that she actually fell out of the galactic center. That's called the fall of the wisdom goddess. She fell out of the galactic center. Her attraction to that world where humanity would evolve its experiment was so great that she was torn out of the galactic center, and she actually plunged out into the area of the galactic limbs, to the area where the anthropos was deposited, which is in the third galactic limb from the center, called the Orion limb. So what is the divine experiment? The divine experiment is two things. First of all, it is just the gods' experiment to see how humanity or various strains of humanity would evolve through planetary worlds. That's all. And so there are many variations of the human or divine experiment happening in our galaxy. You could assume that. However, hold on to your booties for a moment. There is one particular setting of the divine experiment with humanity that is completely unique. And that is the setting on Earth, on the planet we live on. Why is that variation of the experiment so unique? Well, the Gnostic myth is very clear about that. It says a really incredible thing. It tells us a really incredible thing. Not only explains the origin of the human species, which I think I've covered fairly well, but it also explains the origin of the Earth. How did the Earth come to be the Earth? Where did the Earth come from? What is the Earth? How did this planet come into existence? According to this myth, the Earth itself is the transformation of the divine stellar energies of the goddess, Sophia. She turned into a planet. She morphed into this planet. And that is an extremely unusual situation, according to the Gnostic understanding of the way things happen in the universe or in the cosmos, in these galaxies. When she fell out of the galactic core and she extended, you want to visualize that, John, as the galactic core is a vast whirlpool of white, nougat-like pearl, like liquid pearl, of white stellar plasma. And imagine extending from that core a kind of plume or feather of plasma, a spike of plasma. This plasma spike jumped out of the galactic core and extended all the way to the third arm of the galaxy. And from that spike of energy, the Earth itself was formed. And the reason why the Earth is a sentient planet, a live planet, an organic planet, as distinguished from the other planets in our solar system, is because it's actually formed of the primordial energies of this goddess entity, the goddess Sophia, whose name is Wisdom. So the really strange thing happened to Sophia herself. She never anticipated this, but it turned out that she would actually be the planet on which one variation of the human experiment would take place. And this is a completely unique situation, and this is what the Gnostic cosmology teaches us.
It's a great story.
It is such a fantastic story. I just love it. And I have to tell you that it goes even deeper. The dimensions of this story explain everything that we are facing, everything about the human experiment, about our place in the cosmos, about the potentials of human beings. And also, as you note in your notes to me, they also explain this phenomenon of the so-called archons or archontic forces. This is part of the story of Sophia. This is part of the Gnostic cosmology, the origin of the archons and the archontic forces. And this is such an important part of our story because it explains what's wrong with the experiment, why it's going so badly, badly wrong. And it is going wrong, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's fantastic that we have a myth, and I think you would agree with me, you tell me what you think, but that we have a myth that not only gives us the background and the foundation to understand what the divine experiment with humanity is, but it also gives us very clear information on how that experiment is imperiled and at risk. I mean, what more could you ask for than that?
Definitely.
From a myth. Yeah, you know.
Well, I mean, it ties into so many different things. Like, for instance, even if people that are quote-unquote traditional Christians, looking at the creation myth at the beginning of the Bible, it tells of a story of a being that supposedly created us, but yet it doesn't know when we're hiding behind bushes. And it talks about a serpent giving information to the humans.
Right.
And it's just kind of creates this other – when I'm listening to what you're saying, it makes me think of like the serpent representing Sophia possibly.
That's right.
Was
That's
trying
right.
to give the human beings information about their true situation. But I think you'll probably go there.
Exactly. You're really touching such an important point, John. So I want to make two points that I can offer regarding the biblical version of creation, you know, because the Gnostics were very aware of the biblical version of creation. They refer to it often in their writings, but I'll have you understand that they critique it. They point out what is wrong with it. They point out that it is a distorted and wrongly interpreted myth. But one of the things that I would stress at the beginning, before I mention the two points of the biblical myth that relate closely to the Gnostic myth, is that the Gnostics insisted, as did many, many mystic and shamanic traditions in the world, that the serpent power, which is also called Kundalini, the divine serpent energy, is a teacher, healer, and ally to humanity. And one of the biggest mistakes that I see being propagated today in the world by people like David Icke and Tsarian and all these people, Jordan Maxwell or whoever, David Wilcox or whoever, they are talking about this reptilian menace. I'm going to tell you in a moment what the Gnostics told us about the reptilian menace. But they are talking about the reptilian menace. Reptilians this, reptilians that, reptilians are, they are the master race, we are the slaves, they are enslaving humanity, blah, blah, blah. There are some problems with that analysis, but the basic problem is that they do not distinguish between reptilian and serpentine. And the snake energies or the serpentine energies have always been considered to be the divine instructive and healing powers that come from the gods themselves. So I would ask those who are listening to this account of the myth to take that on board and to consider that when I talk about the serpentine energies or Kundalini, the serpent in the Garden of Eden, I'm not talking about reptilians or some kind of reptilian menace working against humanity. Okay? This is such an important distinction. Absolutely crucial distinction. I'm so glad you brought that up. So what are the two points about the biblical account of creation that the Gnostics make so vividly? Well, the first point, and this is really a doozy. This is really a doozy. They say that Jehovah or Yahweh, the God of the Old Testament, who was adopted then, first, you know, the God of the Hebrews, who was then adopted by the Christians, who was then adopted by the Islamic people, is not really the true God. That it is an imposter and it is a demented alien being. And so the message of Gnosticism has various aspects, but one of the most startling things about it that really makes it unique is that it contains a warning. And I have to tell you, my friends, that this warning is explicit and clear as a bell. And the warning is that the entity worshipped and adored in the Abrahamic religions, it's not a true God, but it is an actual entity in our cosmos. Jehovah is an entity, spiritual entity, non-human entity, I should say, that inhabits our solar system, that claims to be the divine creator, but falsely so. And that this entity, Jehovah, or Yahweh, which the Gnostics called Yaldabaoth. It's a very strange word. That's what they called Jehovah, Yaldabaoth. And they said that beware of Yaldabaoth. Beware of the God of the Jews and the God of the Christians, because this God is a demented alien who is actually working against humanity. And that God is the head of the so-called Archons. So that's one of the messages that they said. They said, look, we know about the Jewish creation myth, we know about Genesis and everything. We're just here to warn you what is really happening in this myth. The second thing they said was that the creation of Satan and the demonization of the serpent in the Garden of Eden are complete disinformation. Because actually, in Gnostic view, the serpent in the Garden of Eden is the divine Kundalini force, which is the source of enlightenment and healing. And they actually said, why did the serpent tempt Eve, and why did Eve eat this apple? Well, it's a symbolic way of saying that Eve, who is the feminine or the divine feminine part of our nature, carries the Shakti and the Kundalini. And she carries this inspiring divine healing force. She is the instructor. In fact, it's a very interesting pun that goes from Greek to Aramaic, where the word Eve and the word serpent is a pun. And both the words even serpent mean instructor. So the serpent is our instructor and teacher. It is not satanic. It is not something that causes us to sin. On the contrary, the serpent power in us is what causes us to realize our divine potential, connection with our origins. That is to say, Whistlefire and with the galactic center. So there's a tremendous blowing apart of Judeo-Christian mythology. And there's a tremendous expose that this story that we're told in the Bible is disinformation and lies from one end to the other. And that is largely, my friend, why the Gnostics were murdered and eliminated, and why the Christians spent centuries hunting them down, destroying their books, burning their libraries, killing their teachers, or driving the Gnostics into hiding. Why? Because it's a Gnostic expose that I'm giving you right now. It's the Gnostic view that I'm giving you right now had been given freely at the beginning of Christianity, Christianity would never have been able to become the dominant religion of the world. It would have been defeated by Gnostics and visionaries who saw through it and saw that it was a lie, and a very dangerous lie. So this is a fantastic wake-up call coming to us from these ancient Gnostic teachings.
It almost seems like when we get into the myth of Jesus Christ, that it seems like that even through that story, that there was an attempt to purvey this story, the Gnostic story, but it in itself seemed to have been taken over and stripped completely of the truth, because there does seem to be a difference in what that character was trying to convey to everybody about our origins. And so maybe that's why there's an attachment, I guess, to that character. What do you think about that?
Well, you raise a good question there. You raise a very tricky question, John. It's a difficult question. In fact, I could say that I wrote my entire book on in his image to address that question that you just raised. You know? I would answer it in this way now. You know, that came out in 4 or 5 years ago, and I've had some time to reflect since my book came out. There's 40 years of my life in that book. This figure of Jesus is very unfortunate for us, for humanity. It's an unfortunate figure, a tortured, unfortunate character in the human story. Because on the one hand, when we feel the longing to know the truth about ourselves, our divine destiny, we think somehow that Jesus or Jesus/Christ is going to show us that, don't we? In some vague sense that we feel like, you know, maybe if we got to what Jesus' message really was, or maybe if we knew who Jesus really was, the truth of it, we would get to the truth about ourselves. But I'm sorry to say, folks, man can't get to the truth by that route. And what we have to do is go back to what Gnostics do, and start from their knowledge of the divine self, and go from there. Because everything that we have inherited about Jesus is so corrupted and confused that honestly, it is impossible to sort it out and find if there was originally some true message in it. It's impossible to dig out what it was. I'm sorry to say that, but that is the brutal truth.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah.
So we have this this archonic influence,
right?
And would you say that can you explain real quickly how this happened? How did they come here?
Sure. I'm just wondering how much time are we going to have in this interview? An hour and a half?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. If that's okay with you.
Oh, it's lovely with me. Fine.
Okay.
Okay. Let me say that I just want to ask you, before I start that, I want to ask you a question. Mm-hmm. You know, as far as I know, John, when I wrote On His Image, even years before I wrote it, when I was putting an article about archons on metahistory.org, which is my site, I think I introduced the term archon into the internet. I think so. Other people may have used, I think I brought it into the particular definition that is now being discussed today.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, if I go to certain blogs, I don't write a blog, I don't write forums, but sometimes people write into me and they say, John, you know, hey, take a look at this. Well, recently I was contacted by Laura Magdalene Eisenhower.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, who talks about this, the Fire Myth, and about the archons. And I hadn't heard of her at all. She contacted me a couple of months ago. And then I went to look at her site, and I saw, oh, wow, look, here's all this stuff about the archons. That's exactly what I've been doing, you know? So archon might be a term that many people are using, but whenever I look at a blog or whenever I look at a forum, the concept of the archon is the one that I have introduced. I want to make that clear. So that meme, if you want to call it a meme, the archon meme originates with me. But I'm not saying that to blow my own horn. I'm saying that to indicate to the readers that it doesn't originate with me. It originates from these unique Gnostic teachings. So whenever you hear this archon meme now, you want to go back to these archon teachings, these Gnostic teachings, because that's where it originates from. So, let me give you my quick fix on the archons. We go back to the story of the Divine Sophia. Now, remember that her involvement, her desire, which is called enthymesos, meaning passionate desire or deep burning desire, to be involved in an experiment that she engineered was exceptional. Most of the scientific, artistic gods don't do that. They set the experiment in motion, and they step back, and then let it unfold on its own terms. Sophia was different. She wanted to be involved. She didn't ask her partner, Christos, to get involved with her. She unilaterally decided to get involved herself. The consequence of that was that she plunged from the galactic center. A plume of organic or plasmic light was emanated from the galactic center, and it extended all the way to that third galactic limb, which is where our solar system is located. Then something really, really bizarre happened. And the word that you find is in the Gnostic writings is a Greek word. I would point out, by the way, that the Gnostic writings are written in Coptic language. But the Coptic language really uses a lot of Greek. It's actually a kind of form of Greek written in another script. And so one of every four words in Coptic is a Greek word. So in these mythological texts, you encounter this word, anomou, Greek word, A-N-A-M-O-U. And that word is the root of our word anomalous, an anomie. Anomalous, meaning a freak event. Okay? So, the myth is very clear. When Sophia plunged from the galactic core, when this plume or spike of core energy from the galaxy, and certain writers like Paul LaViolette and other cosmologists are discussing how this could happen, how there could be a power spike from the galactic center. It just merges so beautifully with contemporary science. When this happens, it produces extraordinary conditions in the galactic limbs. Because under normal conditions, the galactic limbs are not subjected to this kind of impact. And so this impact is an anomou. It's a freak event. And the result of this freak event was something that even Sophia herself, the goddess, could not anticipate. She could not have foreseen what happened. when her plasmic energies impacted the atomic matter, the quantum fields, as it were, of the galactic limbs, they produced a kind of fracture zone. The best way that I would describe it, and I've written about this extensively on metahistory.org, is it was a fracture zone. It's sort of like if there was a pond. Imagine a round pond that is kind of shallow, and this pond is frozen because it's winter. And then imagine that if you drop a wrecking ball, a very, very big metal ball, right down into the center of this pond, that it produces a fracture through the entire pond. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Envision that. That's very similar to what happened. Because you see the energies of a goddess, pleromic galactic entity, are very, very different from the energies that are circulating in the galactic limbs. The energies of a divine being are very fluid. They're very porous, highly porous. And yet the energies that are happening in the galactic limbs are very rigid because they have to do with atomic and subatomic matter. They have to do with powerful material energies and fields of electromagnetism and gravity and so forth. And so when the divine current of the goddess impacted this area, it produced this enormous fracture. And Sophia is sort of sitting in the center of this fracture zone that she created. And this in this fracture zone, a whole cosmos arises. In fact, actual entities arise, actual beings, and these are called archons. So the effect of Sophia's fall was that she inadvertently produced an alien species in the galactic limbs called the archons, a kind of like locusts. They're a cybernetic type of species, or cyborg type. And that was something that she didn't expect. Now, again, I'm not making any of this up. The specific language of everything I'm saying can be found in these Gnostic writings. And what's really interesting to observe, and I'm sure you've picked up on this, John, because this has been something that many people have picked up on. You know, I talked on Coast to Coast three times, Coast to Coast AM. Mm-hmm. First time I talked with actually with, not with George Noorni, but with Art Bell himself.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of the last people to interview Art Bell, to have the privilege of talking with Art Bell before he retired, you know, and turned it over to George Noorni. And when I was on Coast to Coast, the day I was on there, I got 250,000 hits on my website. You know?
Yeah.
And people called in. And what were they calling in about? Mostly they were calling in about this Archon thing. Why? Because the Gnostic description of the Archons is the earliest lucid and coherent description that we have of the intrusion of alien beings. It explains the presence of alien beings in our solar system. And as I pointed out in the interview with Art Bell and in my later interviews on Coast to Coast, that there is not a great deal of descriptive detail in the Gnostic documents, but there's enough clues to ascertain that there are two types of archonic or alien ETs described. Two types are described. One type is described as resembling an aborted fetus. That means a prematurely born fetus. Now, what does a prematurely born fetus look like? It's let's say that it's a fully formed body, but it's prematurely born. What does it look like?
It's very frail.
It's very frail. It has a big head, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And very thin limb.
Atrophy, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's atrophied. It's atrophied. It has a big head because the head grows first in the human embryonic development. And so they described what they called the emergence of a strange being, a being of the shadow, which is Haibi, strange word in Coptic, H-A-I-B-E, Haibi, a creature of the shadow. By shadow they mean inorganic matter. Okay? A creature of inorganic matter, an inorganic cyborg entity that has the appearance of an aborted fetus. Okay, that is the, I interpret that to be the gray ETs.
Yeah.
Big heads, big eyes, spindly limbs, and they're very fragile looking. Okay? But wait, it doesn't quit there. Then they go even further. And they say that the first thing that appeared due to Sophia's impact was this, in this animu, this freak event, was that this locust-like species appeared. It didn't even have an environment to live in. It just absolutely appeared by itself, which is really bizarre. And I'd like to explain how that could happen a little later on, if you remind me of that, because there have been scientific experiments that have verified how an inorganic insect species can emerge in certain electrical conditions without even an environment for it to exist in. This has been shown by the so-called Akari experiments that were conducted in the end of the 19th century. A-C-A-R-I, the Akari insects. If you go Google that, you'll find something really interesting. So the first thing that appears is this kind of hive of locust-like cyborg entities. This is actually described in the Gnostic text. Then they say something even more bizarre. They say that among this hive, there arose a mutation of the original entity. And this mutation, this other entity, which belongs to the same species, was actually a very aggressive. Very aggressive and full of rage and full of energy and arrogance. They describe it as full of energy and arrogance. And it took the form, which they call, of a dracon. D-R-A-K-O-N. Dracon, dragon, reptile. Uh-huh. So, the Gnostic Coptic texts actually contain two references to an embryonic or gray ET type and to a reptilian or dracon type of alien. These are dracons. So as I've said in many, many articles that I've written, the Gnostic texts contain the first and earliest textual evidence of the existence of gray ETs and reptilian ETs that we have. This comes from actual evidence and testimony of the Gnostic teachers and seers, and it's absolutely remarkable and unique.
The Dracon, Archon, could perhaps be where the confusion comes in from the serpent knowledge from Gaia or Sophia versus the reptilians that everybody has talked about. That might be where everyone's confused, because this sounds like a confusing point where when you're speaking about this other archonic entity. Is it anything? Is it just maybe a mimic of the original source of what Gaia is?
And that's exactly what it is, John. And that's exactly what the myth says it is. In a number of my writings, you can read, for instance, Who Wrote the Reptilian Agenda? That's one of my writings. If you go to metahistory.org and you go to the site guide and you click on what is called Gnostique, G-N-O-S-T-I-Q-U-E. It's a whole category of metahistory. And then you scroll down the documents, you'll find Archon files. And in the Archon files are most of my writings about this. And in the Archon files, I actually call the Archons a mimic species. They're an inorganic species of beings that inhabit our solar system. Mark well, they do not inhabit the cosmos at large. They do not come from any other planetary system. They are not from Beta Reticulum They are not from Sirius, certainly not from Sirius. They are not from the Pleiades or any place else. They are from our solar system. They are uniquely the inhabitants of our solar system, according to the Gnostic cosmology. And the cosmological texts say that they are a mimic species. They actually use the word mimic or mimon, M-I-M-O-N, in Greek, which is the root of the word meme, by the way. So it's very clear. The Gnostics say that they were a species that is not capable of anything original because they're inorganic. They're like a robotic or hive species, and that they could only do anything at all because the divine Sophia gave them the ability to do it. But at the same time, the serpent power of the divine Sophia, her serpent wisdom, her healing and enlightening wisdom, must never be confused with the Drakon power. They are completely opposed. The Drakon power of the Archons is aggressive, it is blind, it is greedy, it is envious. It can only rip off and cheat and mimic what is real. It cannot offer anything real. It can only perpetrate hoaxes and falsity. They are errors. They are messengers of errors, messengers of deception. They are not evil. I want to point this out. We're not talking here about something satanic and evil. The Gnostic texts are very clear. The Archons are not evil. They are messengers of error and deception. And standing against them is the goddess Sophia, who is the source of wisdom, the source of enlightenment, and the source of the serpentine powers. So really, the battle that's taking place on Earth, the battle that's taking place in this divine experiment, is between the archontic or reptilian powers, if you will, and humanity, which is endowed with the serpentine wisdom, which is actually originates with Sophia herself. This is the picture to hold in your mind. And it's a fantastic picture.
Absolutely. And there's a lot going on with what you just said, with trying to pervert humanity, I don't want to say that it has an agenda, but it's a force that is certainly trying to persuade humanity off its own natural potential and pushing us into almost trying to turn us into what they are, which to me seems the whole transhumanist perspective
that's right.
is push it, it that, that's what we're heading towards.
We
need to be very careful about because, technology can be used for good things, but it seems like that technology is also stripping us from what we are. And would you agree with any of this? What do you think about that?
I totally agree. I not only agree on the basis of my own personal experience and my personal spiritual and intellectual insight, if you will, but my personal insight, such as it is totally based upon the Gnostic view, and the because they were the seers and teachers of the great divine mysteries of Sophia, and I am their student. And as a student and as a reborn mystic and a modern teacher of the mysteries, I can tell you that this is exactly the case. Transhumanism, the claim that we can merge with inorganic artificial intelligence, the claim that we can merge with computers, that we should be chipped, this whole madness is total archontic madness. It's the sign that the human race is being influenced away from our divine potential that Sophia put in us, away from the divine experiment that she would like to have with us, because she's right here on Earth and she's the only one that's here, I have to tell you. It's her and us. And the Archons are meddling and screwing and fucking with our minds. They're mind parasites. One of the things that they do very well, and this is a remarkable, remarkable thing I'm going to tell you now. So many people have picked up on this. I pointed out years ago that the Gnostics said they used a particular Coptic word to describe how the Archons operate. Bear in mind that the Gnostics were seers and shamans. They were capable, they had but they had paranormal abilities. They could remote view. They were shamans, very, very highly accomplished shamans who worked in teams. And so I tend to credit them with a certain authority because they worked in many generations in teams to investigate the supernatural world, to look into the realm of the psychic and paranormal, and to come back with certain observations. And this is one of the most helpful observations that they made, as far as I know. They said that the signature of the Archons is Hal, H-A-L. This is a Coptic word. And what it means is simulation, copying. You could even say it means virtual reality. So when we ask ourselves today, how are we going to relate to this Archon thing? There's some kind of E.T. Archon presence in our world. It's threatening our divine potential. It's threatening our ability to know actually who we are, what divine endowment of skills and talents we have. It's threatening our connection to the divinity of the earth and the fantastic organic intelligence of this planet, which is called Sophia. It's threatening all this. How can we detect this? Well, you detect it in various ways, but primarily by Hal. In other words, everything is archontic, which would give you a false substitute, which you can have for real. That's archontic. For instance, genetically modified food is totally archontic. Because you can actually have real food, organic food, that gives you everything that genetically modified food claims to give you. So why are you going to eat plastic apples when you can eat real apples, you know?
Definitely. And, I mean, there's just already, like, so many organic technologies. You're speaking about how these shamans communicated, and it was through a natural form of communication. There are various ways of doing this, and what's being replaced with that kind of thought process are just these instantly gratifying hows, such as cell phones.
Right. Cell phones, iPads, iPhones, all the technology. Now, I'm not saying that this technology is wrong.
Yeah.
This technology that we're producing is a natural outcome of the genius and inventiveness of our species. Mm-hmm. And Sophia and the Christos, when they designed the human template, designed an enormous capacity for invention, innovation, and novelty into our species. So this is an expression, but it's a dangerous and deviant expression. And if we give ourselves over as individuals and a species to these archontic devices, we will actually end up substituting so many things for the direct experience of life that we don't have our lives anymore. We're actually going to negotiate our lives away and give our lives away to this simulations, these simulations, you know? And the Gnostics warned us about Hal, H-A-L, which means simulation or faking, hoaxing. They warned us about that, and it's so, to me, it's absolutely fantastic that how relevant today is the warning that they, announced some 2,000 years ago, and that they were murdered and destroyed for giving us this warning.
Uh-huh.
But I'm back here to tell you that the warning is here, and I give the same warning. And I would like to kind of bring our conversation here to a certain point of conclusion, certain point of enlightenment by saying this. The purpose of the divine experiment here on Earth is for the human species who was engineered in the imagination of Gaia, Sophia, to interact with that engineer. Our purpose here on being in, being here on Earth is to interact with the goddess who originated and conceived our species. And everything that we invent by make-believe or technology that gets in the way of that is going to destroy us. And we're very, very close to the brink. It's gone very, very far. Very far.
And a lot more difficult to connect with Gaia because of all these distractions.
That's right. That's right. Because of all this technology and these simulation devices, whereas the connection with, I call her Gaia Sophia. It's just a way of saying that the Sophia goddess of the Gnostic myth morphed into the planet Earth. Now, that is also not my invention, not my fabrication. You can actually read the textual descriptions of that if you go into metahistory.org and you look at the proper the essays and so forth under Gaia Sophia. I describe in detail. I reconstruct the myth in every single detail. The wonderful thing about this myth, John, is that it is a participatory myth. You know, if you go back, for instance, and you look into mythology and you say, okay, Prometheus, you know, we're going to go into Greek mythology, for instance, and we're going to investigate who was Prometheus. And we're going to find out that Prometheus stole fire from the gods. And we'll read this story about Prometheus and what he did. Or we'll read the story about Orpheus, or read the story about Icarus, whose father was Daedalus, who made these wings. And so Icarus took the wings that his father made and attached them with wax to his body and flew in the sky. So he was the first man to fly, but he flew too close to the sun and the wax melted and he lost his wings and he fell. You can read countless myths like this from Japan to Polynesia to Greece, and they don't go anywhere. They're just myths that tell a certain story. The myth of the divine Sophia is still happening right now. This conversation that you and I are having is part of her myth.